Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Three men have been arrested and facing charges now after a pair of robberies at UAlbany's main campus late last night. The three are from Brooklyn. They are all students at UAlbany.
Seven students at the University of Albany were charged with one count of hazing, a misdemeanor, after allegedly forcing a Bronx teen to drink half a gallon of vodka.
Albany students were taken to Albany Medical Center overnight after a fight that broke out at an off-campus party.
Duffy died after a night of heavy drinking at an off-campus home in November. He and five other students were rushed to the hospital for alcohol poisoning.
An online bomb threat ends in felony charges for one University at Albany student.
About an hour ago, we were notified about a UAlbany student in critical condition after a night of drinking.
A UAlbany student has been arrested after allegedly breaking into another student's dorm and sexually abusing her. Danny Lee is charged with burglary and sex abuse. The incident happened overnight Thursday.
Two UAlbany students are in custody today after police say they held up another student on campus. Stephen Keshola and Kareem Abdelmanim are facing robbery, assault, grand larceny, and conspiracy charges. Albany student Derek Engelman, you see here, he's in jail without bail right now in Albany County on a slew of charges, including burglary and sex abuse.
UAlbany and Gilderland police are investigating tonight after they say they found a dog dead in the woods near one of the buildings on campus.
A UAlbany college student is dead tonight after police say that he drank too much alcohol.
She was one of five teens rushed to the hospital over the weekend and was unconscious when officers got to the off-campus house.
Just seven people now face charges after police say that their hazing of UAlbany students joining a fraternity went too far. Officers say that they found pledges face down in water and begging for mercy. But as Brandon Lewis discovered, neighbors say that that incident and others like it are all too common.
What I can say is that that was an isolated incident and that there hasn't been an incident since.
UAlbany has a reputation of being so outrageous and dangerous. I don't think anyone was surprised that this incident happened in the first place. I think what was unique about this case was how aggressively the university, the media, and the DA's office responded once race was brought up.
The cows, context of white supremacy, Gusty Renegade, in for another broadcast. Hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, November 30th, 2016. So I have been told. We'll be here tomorrow for Workplace Racism, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The program for today, one of our listeners, and I believe in the Florida area, they participated in our compensatory call-in this past weekend, and they mentioned a case that we had talked about quite a bit over the past year almost, the incident that happened at the University of Albany, which is in New York State, not New York City, but still New York City, where these three black female scholars, they reported that they were on a bus. It was a late weekend evening, and that they were racially terrorized by these intoxicated whites on a bus. It was white females, white males involved, believed to be intoxicated. They did not get assistance. This got talked about quite a bit. And then after a few weeks after the initial reports came out, they announced that they had video footage from the bus and that the footage contradicted what these three young females, what they alleged, that they had been racially attacked. And they decided that they were going to charge the three black females. They were going to charge them with making a false report and that they actually were the aggressors against the whites on the bus. We talked about this incident, kind of followed up. They were the three black female scholars. They were also facing disciplinary action at the school. We talked about this, I think, kind of the last bits that I'd heard were around the summertime, around the time shortly after the punitive action was taken by the school. Our listener informed us over the weekend that there was this great new documentary film giving more information about this case, what took place, and just more information for folks to consider. I remember telling people back when all this took place that I think this was a really important incident, something that we should kind of keep an eye on, pay attention as things unfold. So I'm glad we are having the opportunity this evening to re-examine this incident and learn as much as we can what this incident reveals about the system of racism, white supremacy. The documentary, it is titled Indefensible, The Wrongful Prosecution of the UAlbany 3. It is available online. The address, you should be able to click the link in the description if you're listening at Black Talk Radio. The address is indefensibledocumentary.com. indefensibledocumentary.com. You can go there to get more information. You can watch it. You can download it, share it with other folks. Really interesting segment, and we're so glad to have the filmmakers with us on the program this evening. For the filmmakers, they are calling in. If you could press *6 on your line and then the number 1, and that way I'll be able to recognize where our filmmakers are located since they are calling us. So again, if you could press *6, and there we go, have one of them. The filmmakers for Indefensible, are you with us?
Hi, hello?
Greetings, yes sir, we can hear you.
That's amazing, I wasn't sure how this was going to work.
It's not too hard, just a phone call away. So thankful you could share a bit of your time with us on the program. For our listeners, just letting folks know, our guest, he wanted to remain anonymous just for reasons of personal safety. Do you want to share with our listeners before we get started why you raised those concerns about remaining anonymous?
I'm in the community that I'm in. I'm sure it's not a huge secret who was behind the documentary, but just for to keep the focus on the case at large and the black leadership that's already in the community kind of pushing the campaign to support these women and to keep the focus on them and not the filmmakers or the people behind the scenes. We figured to be in the best interest to remain anonymous. And also just because anytime you go against, you know, the police or district attorneys or a city, you do run a risk of some retaliation or reprisal. So we figured we could subvert all that by just kind of putting out the documentary as is and letting it speak for itself.
I think I got disconnected. I was confused because I wasn't hearing anything, so I was trying to figure out if I got disconnected or if our guest got disconnected. Okay, the point that I dropped.
Oh, that's right. I took over the show. We did a commercial break. It was great.
Much obliged. Much obliged. Okay, when I dropped out, you were giving your concerns about why you wanted to be anonymous, keeping the focus on the victims in the case, and what you wanted the priority to be, and that it was not too difficult for people in your area to figure out the people that were involved with this project to begin with. Just for clarity, just to ask, any of the victims, the three black female scholars in this case, Alexis Briggs, their names are all publicized. This is not anything to Ariel Agudio and Aisha Burwell. Were they affiliated with the project in any way?
We were in contact with them when we decided to do the undertaking, so they knew that it was coming out. I think the incident itself, believe it or not, is kind of bigger than them as an individual. So we had planned to do the documentary even if they didn't consent to it, because we just felt that this is something that could potentially happen to other you know, people in similar situations. So we were hopeful that they would be on board with it. And, you know, without saying too much, because they are still under, you know, legal proceedings, they were aware that the documentary was being created.
Okay. Anybody involved with the project, like related to them, or have any, you know, relationship, as they would say, with any of these folks, just that might be important to know about who was involved with this project?
Yeah, as we were gathering information, we reached out to the families. We reached out to the individuals on the bus, both them and also other, you know, people who were witnesses and present on the bus, people who were interrogated by the police. We reached out to friends and other people who are familiar with the UAlbany campus and culture, and the defense attorneys. So we pretty much reached out to all parties involved, with the exception of the prosecution, because their stance has already been well publicized and put out into the media, and also law enforcement, because we had all of the discovery files and everything that was presented from law enforcement to the defense team.
Wow, that is interesting. Again, you can watch the video, download it, share it, indefensibledocumentary.com. I did not see, unless I missed it, any of the white people who offered their perspective. Did you reach out to any of them, any of the white people who said that, hey, they were victims who took a different stance from what was reported about this incident originally, to ask them to be a part of the project as well?
We didn't reach out to them to ask them to be involved, but we did reach out to a few of the people who were on the bus and who were witnesses. Mm-hmm. Again, the point of the documentary wasn't necessarily to focus on the side of the white people involved there, and we felt that their side had already been presented pretty well by the media and law enforcement, the university and everything. And the purpose was to kind of give another perspective. But in doing so, we really wanted to know where they were coming from. So we did reach out to some folks. We didn't, you know, they weren't really responsive once they learned what the nature of the documentary was. But we were still able to get, you know, all their original witness statements and testimony and all the video testimony that they had given to the police. So we had that to refer to. So we definitely got all sides involved when we started the documentary.
Okay. For our listeners, we ask this question of all the folks who come on the program. Are you a black male?
Yes.
Okay. Important information to know. The University of Albany, for folks that are listening in, according to the information listed online, the student body, undergraduate student body, is approximately 13,000, and the black percentage of that is about a little over 17%. So we're talking approximately 2,200 black students on campus. Does that sound about accurate to you?
Correct, yep.
Okay. Were you a student? Are you a student now? Have you ever been a student at the University of Albany?
I'm very familiar with the campus in the area, and even in doing this documentary, we had people go out and kind of film and document the climate on the nights, similar to like the night that this occurred. We had people go and not recreate the environment, but just kind of get reacclimated to it. And yes, the people who were involved in making the documentary are from the area, and it's a relatively small area, and we're intimately familiar with the university and the police and the district attorney.
Okay. You yourself are not a student?
I am not a student, no.
Okay. Why does the documentary Indefensible, why does it start with this kind of montage? This is also the audio segment we began the program with. Why does it start with this montage of all these different criminal incidents that have happened involving students at the University of Albany?
Well, for two reasons. One, because we were, just to be petty, like we had an issue with the way that the university has been treating these women, and we wanted to agitate them. But on a more like logistical and purposeful meaning, it was really just because people aren't familiar with the culture on the campus and how the university atmosphere is. And we felt that this case had kind of Once the spotlight was shown on it, they were trying to make it seem as if this incident was like extremely unique, and the circumstances happening deserved all of this attention from the police and this aggressive prosecution. And we just wanted to remind people that this is not a safe campus. The culture on the campus is very dangerous, and there's rampant misogyny and racism and violence and abuse that happens there all the time. The only thing that made this case unique was that race was brought up and it was prosecuted very harshly. And some of those other incidents that you saw in the news clippings were kind of swept under the rug. They weren't prosecuted that harshly. Very few people were arrested at some of those riots that you saw in that footage. So we were kind of doing a comparison of the way the university treated this incident versus how they've treated incidents in the past.
Fascinating. Wow. It just from what I saw in that montage of all these other incidents, and it seemed like a lot of these other incidents involved white students, unless, you know, I missed something. It seemed like a big theme was white students and their debauchery. I mean, you had deaths from what I heard in that clip, like people dying, consuming too much alcohol and all of these other shenanigans going on. White students, alcohol. On this program, consistently, I remind our listeners that's a dangerous combination. Is that something that gets seriously addressed on campus? Because that seems like it was a major contributing factor to the incident with these three black female scholars on the night in question, alcohol, specifically white people under the influence of alcohol. But is that something that's specifically addressed, underage drinking and just binge consumption of alcohol?
So campus drinking and some of the things that we showed at the beginning, we've had people say, well, this happens at every university. People drink at every university. And I think that's true by and large. But it's important to remember that UAlbany is unique because there was a long period of time where SUNY Albany in particular was the number one party school in the country. And basically what that meant was there were just raging parties and rampant alcohol use. So it's not like this is your run-of-the-mill state university. For a long time, they were the top of the heap in terms of partying, and several events and celebrations that used to occur at the campus have been shut down because the alcohol abuse was so rampant and people were dying from overdosing. So stuff happens everywhere. At UAlbany, there's like a heightened culture, and it because it's predominantly white school, it's usually involving white students. There's about 10% African. Go to indefensibledocumentary.com and see the documentary. And if you're curious about ways that you can support these women, you can click on the link to the right at the top of the page that has some steps that you can do to help support UAlbany 3.
Outstanding. Just the statistical information that you were talking about, since there's so much drinking is such a big issue and with some of these disciplinary problems on campus, do you know how many students on average are expelled per year at the University of Albany?
Oh, no, I don't. Okay. I don't have those figures.
Okay. That would be something I'd be curious to know, because that has bearing on this case with the disciplinary action that the university took against these three black female scholars. But that's something that I would I will do some digging just for my own edification.
One thing we did look at, though, was how often people who are suspended or expelled are present at their trial, their hearing at the campus. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of the time, over 90%, the student is there to offer some defense for their own student conduct hearing or trials where they could potentially be suspended or expelled. Mm-hmm. Now, that wasn't really afforded to these women because they were facing criminal proceedings at the same time. So they couldn't be at the university trial, the university hearing, to defend themselves because it would have been a conflict of interest, and they could have potentially incriminated themselves for the legal proceedings, which were also brought forth by the university. So it was an interesting dynamic where they couldn't even defend themselves at the SUNY trial, but because they had to defend themselves at the criminal trial.
Right. Important issue as well. What was the budget for this project?
This is an independent project. It was pretty low budget. It was fortunately, there were just some talented and committed people who wanted to put this information out there. You can do a lot now with a relatively small budget. So essentially, once we procured the cameras and the video editing equipment, the rest really came down to coming up with the direction, who we wanted to speak to, and kind of what the plan was to proceed with the narrative we were trying to tell and what we were trying to convey to people. So it wasn't very expensive to produce, and that's just due to good resource management and people who were committed to getting this information out.
Outstanding. I might have to tell our listeners, this to me seems like an outstanding illustration of Black self-respect coming to the aid of these Black female scholars. I want to just kind of, you can address concerns from the original incident way back in January of this year, almost a year ago, from how this incident was originally reported and what concerns you had about that, which you all try to highlight in the film. I just want to play a quick sound clip. This is from the film, and you all actually got some of the recordings of the initial interviews where these three victims, mm-hmm. where they were reporting what happened on the bus, where they kind of were able to give some of their testimony to the enforcement officials. And you have some really important points in this segment. It's only about a minute or so. But just the thing I would like listeners to pay attention to, because we focus a lot of attention on words on this program. So ratchet becomes one important one. And then the other theme in terms of who gets to be loud and angry in public, and how we respond to a white person being loud and angry and even under the influence of alcohol in public, and then how we respond to a Black person who's perceived to be loud or angry in public. We hear this quick segment from the clip, Indefensible, and then we will hear from the filmmaker, Context of White Supremacy.
But then, like, behind our backs, well, their backs, but they didn't notice I was looking. She's rolling her eyes, and then I hear ratchet bitches.
That's when she said, she made a comment and called me, like, a ratchet viewer.
A drunk girl and her friends call Ariel ratchet for being loud.
Excuse me, I've never heard that term before. What does that mean?
It's like ghetto, basically. I mean, it doesn't have to mean Black people, but it's just like, if that's the first thing you're gonna say about a group of Black girls who just offers you a sandwich, it's kind of like you're only saying it because they're Black.
Ratchet is like, there's like another word for ghetto, so ratchet's like.
Okay, it's a derogatory term.
Right. Okay.
So I'm really angry. I'm just like, are you serious? What did you say? Like, what did you just say? After, like, getting upset, everyone just says, calm down. So I was like, I'm just going to calm down. It's not even worth it. Like, they kept on even saying, it's not even worth it. And I, like I said, my intention wasn't fighting her. So I just sat back down. It was, like, cool down time. And I saw that she had, like, gotten quiet. So I was like, okay. Like, everything's going to be okay. So then we started talking, because they were like, why are you so mad? The guy started asking me.
She started, like, having the conversation about how, like, why is it that when I started getting loud, people are making it seem like I'm, like, this loud Black girl, when this girl was being obnoxious and loud the whole time and no one said anything.
And then she was like, how come this white girl back here gets to sing loudly, nobody says anything, but as soon as I get up to stand up for myself, everybody's like, shut up, you're so ratchet, you're so ghetto.
Because the whole bus was just saying, like, shut up, be quiet, but like, they were just saying a whole bunch of stuff, and I was like, everyone tells us to shut up when we get into, like, all altercation, but no one said shut up to the girl who was screaming this whole ride. Like, you guys even got involved with her singing, and that's annoying. Like, not all of us are drunk, not all of us want to hear that right now. So basically, they're like understanding. They're like, oh, yeah, like we didn't even notice that everybody got riled up once the Black girl started screaming.
Ariel and the guys were talking civilly about how white people don't know how it feels to be Black, and how, like, Black people are always, you know, kind of getting treated differently for things that, like, white people would do, you know what I mean, in that sense. So they were talking, like, civilly, so out of nowhere, the drunk girl in the back goes, are you fucking kidding me? You guys are so ignorant.
She was like, oh my effing God, you guys are so effing ignorant.
You're fucking ignorant. You have to get a fucking job.
Blah, 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 blah.
She didn't
have to be ignorant. Ignorant for thinking that, like, we're being treated differently because we're Black.
Being treated differently because they are Black. That is directly from the film, and direct recording from immediately after this incident took place, which is important for a lot of reasons. Just what is the significance of getting the recording of the interview, and specifically what they're testifying as to how all of this began on that night back in January?
Yeah, so we wanted to make sure that we had the video testimony from when they were giving their statement to the police, which was relatively shortly after the incident, and we just wanted to, we had to know what the women were saying, you know, before we could present it to people in a tangible way. So there was a lot of footage, we should say, that the interrogations, and at this point they're victim statements, but they're being carried out almost like interrogations from the get-go. The police were treating the three women as if they were the suspects. But there was about 15 hours, just under 15 hours of video footage of just their discussions with the police. And, you know, we just wanted to demonstrate the different ways that there was a lapse in judgment, and the police really weren't communicating with the black women or really understanding the ways that race played a role in this. And that's kind of speaks to some of the disconnect between, you know, white law enforcement officers and attorneys and university administrators and the age difference there. So they had to literally explain why some of the things they were called were racist and antagonistic.
Do you think that's certainly valid, right? You hear in the recording where they're saying, hey, what does ratchet mean? The white people that are questioning her, what does that mean? I've never heard that term before. So that's valid. That could be. I'm sure there are some black people who this might be their first time hearing that term. But do you think in terms of the conduct, the way that the enforcement officials responded and many others responded to these black females claim their report that they were racially terrorized, with disbelief, as you said, not questioning them as though they are victims, questioning, interrogating them as though they could be the perpetrators in this crime from the very beginning. Do you think that could be just a part of a broader pattern of how whites deliberately practice racism against black people by invalidating our reports of racism?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the way the black women were treated by the police was pretty startling to watch. You could see from early on, they didn't want this to be about race. So the women would continue to bring up the ways that race played a role, and the officers would continue to try to dismiss it. One of the women in particular, you could tell the police were trying to like almost break her and get her to like confess on behalf of her friends to say that what happened didn't happen, or to try and dismiss the ways that race played a role. They would talk about the discussion they were having about racism right before the fight broke out, and the police would just kind of like, okay, after that, what happened after that, you know? And then also, when explaining what ratchet meant, the women had to like break down exactly how it related to race, and they chalked it up to just a derogatory term, kind of leaving out the racial component. And then lastly, when the women were told that to get a job, which was ultimately the final straw that spurned the fight, the police kind of just dismissed it and didn't even see the racial connotation there. And those three incidents, the ratchet, the conversation about race, and being told to get a job, in my mind, and I think in a lot of the people who viewed the documentary's mind, was more than enough information to make a call to 911 and say that the fight was racially motivated. You know, race played a factor in the fight. And despite that, the police still charged them for falsely reporting a crime, a hate crime, saying race played no factor when it really was the predominant factor.
The significance of how being perceived as angry black women, how that impacted the situation?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, if this case were white people, would be handled differently. Even if it were black men, it would be handled differently. I think because they're black women in particular, there's just this urge to not only not believe them, but also like further demonize them for it, because, you know, boys are known for fighting, right? So that would kind of be, I think it would be more likely to be dismissed. Because they were women, there was this campaign by the media and different people in social spheres kind of just trying to demonize them and show them in what I believe was an even worse light. And I also think the reason that their claims were dismissed as a hoax and so handily like dismissed, just not believed, was related to them being women.
What would your response be to folks who said, well, wait a minute, when this report first came out, there were a sizable number of people who seemed to sympathize with the black females in this case. Front runner for the White House at the time, Hillary Clinton, she tweeted about this incident to help, you know, promote the story. as did many other news outlets. You, even within the documentary, I mean, there's no shortage of media coverage, particularly, I would say, over the first mm-hmm. 2-3 months of this incident. And even though there was a lot of criticism, there also was a sizable number of people who were very sympathetic and supportive. Yes?
Yeah, there definitely was early on. I think two things changed that. One, very quickly, the university decided that they didn't want to defend the women. They wanted the race aspect to go away. So the easiest way to make the racial aspect go away is to say that the women made it up and kind of dismiss their claim. So I think the university did that, and then the media jumped right on board to kind of discredit what they were saying. I'm sorry, can you repeat the last part of that? I think I blanked there for a second.
In general, right, there was a lot of media attention on this incident, and there seemed to be a sizable number of people who were sympathetic and supportive of the victims.
Okay, it didn't got seem it back.
Okay.
The other thing that I think changed it, too, aside from the media, right, so the media kind of switched the narrative. The other thing that changed it was obviously when the video came out and the women were defending themselves. And I think if the women had been, this is such, an odd dynamic, but if the women had been hurt more or didn't defend themselves, I think people would have been more sympathetic to them. Because the women defended themselves, it was easier to paint them as the aggressors, okay? And I think that kind of ties into white supremacy, too, because, typically, if a person is being oppressed or abused and they're a marginalized group, if they do it quietly or peacefully, they're liable to get more sympathy or more approval from the powers that be in society at large. Because these women were involved in a fight and they had the audacity to fight back, and it doesn't look pretty. Like, fights don't look pretty. People were quick to say, these women are not victims. They fought back. They defended themselves. They're the aggressors now. And I think that was those two reasons are why the support wavered early on.
Okay. Context of white supremacy. We're discussing the documentary film Indefensible, which examines the persecution of the Albany Three, these three black female scholars, from an incident that happened on a bus in January of this year. If folks have questions you would like to ask, feel free to dial in as well. I know we have a lot of listeners in the New York area and just in general. As I said, we've kind of been talking about this film project for a good chunk of the year. What you address this in the film. What is your assessment of how the president of the University of Albany, President Jones, who is a black male for listeners, how he responded to this incident?
So, yeah, he's a black male. He's since stepped down, but he's a black male, and also the district attorney prosecuting the case is a black male. The assistant DA is actually the one leading the prosecution, but the head district attorney is a black male. And I think it's just important to remember that they're still working within a system that is upheld by white supremacy and led by white supremacy. So just because they're black, I mean, it's not going to change the way that they react to this or the way that they handle this incident. And I think that's pretty apparent by the way that they handled it. Now, the president at the time, at first he was supportive. And I think early on, like within the first 24 to 48 hours, I believe the board got to him or he just decided that this was something that they wanted that was going to tarnish the school's reputation. And I think, first and foremost, the job of the board and the president is to protect the school's reputation. And they colluded with, I believe, law enforcement and the mayor. I have some information to kind of corroborate that this backroom deal happened very early on to say that we're going to go with the story that the women lied. The university's reputation will be saved. We'll just suspend them, and they'll be prosecuted, and that will help protect the university. And again, this happened before an investigation was even done. This was in the first 48 hours. So I think he changed his stance early on because his first priority was to protect the university's reputation.
Wow. There was a white male student, or I'm sure there were many, but there was a white male student, Jeffrey Rosencheck, where he wrote a letter where he demanded that the former president, Jones, that he apologize for the way that he conducted himself when all of this first happened, just expressed outrage, and he had to give like a long press conference. President Jones at the time, he had to give a long press conference after it came out later that the victims were going to be charged, and they asked him all these questions about, were you reckless? It was fascinating illustration study in racism, white supremacy. I think exactly what you pointed out at the beginning of your response, how within a system of racism, white supremacy, you can have a black person in a position of power, quote unquote, but they are still going to have to respond to do the bidding of racism, white supremacy, and how they handle these things, even though it may look like they have some power, authority, whatever the case. I thought it was fascinating with the backroom deal that you were talking about. I don't think I saw any of that in the documentary film. Is that what did you not?
Yeah, there was something that we had some issues getting it in there. There's some legal things we were dealing with, and we couldn't really find a safe way to get that information out there and in a way that we could corroborate enough, I think, to make it worthwhile to the film. But we do have on good authority that this occurred very early on, and it went very high up, including the mayor, the district attorney's office, and the university, that they knew what narrative they were going to go with before the investigation was complete. It had just, you know, begun, and it was underway. Now, speaking of Jeffrey Rosenhack, I did read that letter when he sent it out, and basically he was asking the president of the university for an apology for issuing an email saying that the women were harassed and assaulted, and kind of just believing the women, or at least saying this is what happened on the bus, and we'd like to support them. So that student felt like because the president didn't say this allegedly happened or this may have had to do with race, that it was irresponsible, and that led to the rally. And in that letter, he went on to say that he didn't believe that, actually, here I'll quote him. He said, "To me, this is not a racial problem. This is not a gender problem. This is not black versus white or male versus female. It's about due process." So I would just like to formally ask Jeffrey Rosenhack for an apology after seeing the documentary, and now he sees the ways that race played a role. I think he should recant his letter and consider apologizing now that he knows better.
I'll be curious if you get that apology. Just for additional information, they gave an interview to Jeffrey Rosenhack. This is a fascinating case study on so many levels. I think it reveals so many elements of how racism, white supremacy operates, and just standard things that happen. White victimization. In fact, I'd like to get you to comment to that, because I think that's rife in this incident. I think even some of these black female scholars, they ultimately ended up being charged as the aggressors, and the white people were the victims in this case. That's such a major element in this case. But this is Jeffrey Rosenhack, and he's giving an interview where he's talking about this letter where he's demanding an apology of the former president, a black male of the University of Albany. It's like 60 seconds.
You're a senior at this school. You've been here for 4 years, I imagine. Probably seen a lot of demonstrations about race relations and things like that. Does the fact that these three girls came out and reported this falsely hurt this cause of, you know, trying to close the gap on race relations and making sure that, you know, we do address this problem?
Well, I specifically don't want to comment about race in this instance because my letter was not about it. It's about the fact that our president did not give any of these students due process. There was no fair trial, and he took these girls' word for it that it actually happened, and we're finding out it didn't. So it's not fair at all.
What would you like to see now?
I would personally, now with these charges being brought against these girls, I would like to see a formal apology saying that he was rash in his decision to send out an email saying that these students actually did this.
Context of white supremacy. I really want to get your thoughts on white victimization, but I want to give you an opportunity. Anything you want to say in response to that clip?
Just use your judgment. This guy, he's a teenage white cis heteronormative male. Like, this is his view is always presented out here. And why is, you know, why are, is the news interviewing this random student for a letter he wrote? Why aren't they interviewing some of the people closer to the case? Why aren't they interviewing black women on campus? Why aren't they interviewing Professor Dr. Chandler, who's a university professor who actually came out in support of the women? Why aren't they interviewing people that matter? Instead, they go right from the, you know, the typical white male perspective of the prosecution and the law enforcement and the university, and they just find the first white male student who says something, and suddenly he's given airtime. He's getting an interview on the news. I know there were there are tons of black liberation movements in this area who were working to defend those women, and they weren't reached out to speak to the media. So the media was very calculated in what they chose to present, and that's part of the reason that this documentary was done independently, because we wanted to express that, and we wanted to offer a counter-narrative.
And your thoughts, because in my view, I could be wrong, white victimization is a huge aspect of this case. That Mr. Rosencheck, saying that he is a victim, he wants an apology. Some of the white individuals who were on the bus saying that they were victims to Negro aggression, and they want an apology, or they want a prosecution. They want justice because they were victimized. Just can you speak to white victimization in this case?
I mean, this guy would have to do some serious mental gymnastics to explain how he was victimized. He wasn't even on the bus, you know. And I think this is just a knee-jerk reaction when somebody says that they're oppressed or victimized. You know, people try to find a way that they've been victimized. And I also think it's possible that there can be more than one victim in a situation. Definitely not Jeffrey Rosencheck, but it's possible that a fight broke out on the any fight could happen, right? Anywhere. And two people involved or two parties involved or more can all be victimized during that encounter or that fight. But that doesn't dismiss the fact that in this case, the black women were also victims, you know, and to say that they're not victims at all, only white people can be victims in this case, is just that's classic white supremacy. It's derailing. It's not true.
I know for a lot of people, when the video was released, edited portions of the video was released, that had a major impact on how people talked about, perceived this case, and saying that it shows that white people were not engaged in any sort of racial antagonism, and that the black females in this case, that they were the aggressors. What do you make of how the video footage was released and the editing in terms of, it's not like they just put everything out so everybody could sit down the first time through and see everything from all the angles. What do you make of how the video footage was released?
Well, the video footage was released to the media first. Well, they let a few people in the community see it, then it was released to the media. And, of course, the media is trying to make an interesting story. So they're going to crop out the parts that are boring. And I watched that entire video from multiple camera angles. It's boring. But the parts that they kept in were the best blows, the biggest hits, hair getting ripped out, you know. So they started the video in the media from a very, you know, limited view, and that gave people the impression that the black women were the aggressors. It also didn't make them look like victims because they had the audacity to fight back. And I think, you know, that was intentional, and that was misleading, a way to mislead the public. Now, when the full video was finally released by the district attorney office, it was, you know, put on a website that nobody went to. Nobody's going to download gigs and gigs of video, watch it all, listen to the audio. So the fact that it was later released in its entirety didn't really benefit the women, because by then people had already made up their mind from the little clips that were present on the news.
From the evidence that you've seen, the testimony that you've read, what's your conclusion about who initiated physical violence?
So I've seen every angle that's available from the video. I think what I was trying to get across in the documentary is that it doesn't matter, because I live in the city, so I see the fights that happen every week in this neighborhood, in this community, from drunken UAlbany students. It's worth noting the black women weren't drunk, but the white students were. You cannot tell who started the fight. You can hear the words that prompted the fight. It's the racial, you know, words getting thrown back and forth, calling them ratchet, and then the last thing saying, why don't you get a fucking job? And that's what spurns the fight. But you can't see who throws the first blow. It's he said, she said at that point. And it doesn't matter, because fights happen all the time in the city, and college students fight. What matters is that even if the black women somehow through the first blow. One, that doesn't mean they started the fight because they were antagonized, and violence takes many forms, and I think you have to be part of a marginalized group to fully appreciate what that means. But also that the way they've been treated since then is unjust, right? So even if they were involved and started the fight and just went in there maliciously and just started kicking people for no reason, the way they've been prosecuted by the university and being charged by, you know, the district attorney, the way they're aggressively prosecuting the case is not fair. The way they were slandered by the media and kind of told, you know, the media kind of told the public that they were lying and this is a hoax and just going against them, it doesn't afford them a fair trial. So what we were trying to convey is that no matter what happened that evening, they've been maligned, basically, by the criminal justice system, and that we have to do better. And we can't only throw the book at suspects who happen to be black or happen to be women. We have to either apply the law equally across the board or make sure that we point out when these injustices are happening so that we can reverse them.
Context of white supremacy. Again, we're discussing Indefensible, the documentary on the University of Albany 3, these three black female scholars who had this terrible incident on a public bus in New York back in January and has ended up just being a horrendous episode in their young lives. I certainly understand when you were giving us your response. I certainly understand where you were, your premise where you said it doesn't really matter who struck first, and that violence takes many forms, not just in terms of physical violence and the racial verbal assault, right, that precipitated all of this. Mm-hmm. But just from your research, the footage that you've seen, are you able to determine who, in your opinion, initiated physical violence?
Yeah, I mean, in from without being able to see it, just from, you know, what you can see, it seemed to me like Aisha was swung at first. And the only reason I say that is because in the video, you can clearly see that she like jerks away. She backs away at one point. And I think what happened was someone took a swing at her. And this is what she says in her version of events. Someone took a swing at her and then the fight was on. So I believe that the, you know, one of the drunk women kind of who was yelling, you know, get a job and all this, took a swing at her, a drunken swing. And that's what started the fight. But again, you can't see who throws or lands the first blow. And I think people have been so obsessed with, well, who punched first? That's how this fight started. And it's like, to do that, you kind of have to dismiss all the nuance, all the context of what led up to the actual incident happening.
There's that word context again. Very important. I guess for our listeners, because I also thought this was important, the rally that took place, before I kind of get forward to some of the things that happened with the court and the school punitive action as well, there was a massive rally. Hundreds of people came out to support these young black female scholars and just to show their allegiance with what happened. Can you talk about the significance of that rally and how that maybe factored into how prosecution and university officials responded?
Yeah, you know, I was present at the rally. It was a beautiful ordeal. Basically, several black women on campus organized the rally, and it wasn't specifically related to that incident. It was in defense of black women all over the campus, because so many people, so many black women heard the story and it resonated with them, because they know what it's like to be black and on a UAlbany bus and be surrounded by drunken white people and drunken white men and women. And that incident spurned this rally, which was just generally in support of black women. Rosa Clemente spoke, Amani O spoke, and also the three women were asked to speak. They didn't organize the rally, but they were asked to speak, and they spoke briefly. So the rally was just kind of a show of solidarity for all black women on campus, and it was very empowering and uplifting, and I think so many people came that was another reason that the university wanted to kind of dismiss what happened and try and pass it all off as a hoax. But yeah, it was very powerful. And although the women didn't organize it, the three women didn't organize the rally or call the rally, they were essentially charged for their role in being present at the rally. And that was count number 11, which we focused on in the documentary.
Wow. Context of white supremacy. I do see we have some folks who called in. Couple quick things I want to get to before I get to some of the folks who dialed in. You have two of the three black females in this situation. They still have charges pending. Is that Ariel Agudio and Aisha Burwell? They still have, their case is still pending. Is that correct?
Yes, two of the black women have cases pending.
Okay. And as I read in the New York Daily News, Agudio, she's facing one count of assault, three counts of attempted assault, three counts of false reporting, and three counts of harassment. Burwell is charged with one count of assault, four counts of false reporting, and one count of harassment. Both Agudio and Burwell, they both had an opportunity to take a plea deal where they could have completely avoided jail time, got, I think, 100 hours of community service, and just kind of had some resolution, at least with the criminal aspect of this case. They declined to do so. Mm-hmm. And so the case is moving forward. I thought that was significant to move forward because they're facing jail time if they are convicted on these counts. Mm-hmm. It could be up to 2 years from what I've read. What is the significance of them turning down this plea deal?
I mean, you know, 96% of cases in this country are resolved by a plea deal, so I wasn't surprised that they were offered a plea deal. It seemed like the university, again, was more concerned with their reputation, so they had this plea deal on the table, which revolved around them, the women just apologizing and saying they made it all up. The women held out because they knew that they didn't, you know, what had happened to them didn't fall outside the realm of what they told 911 and what they told the police, and that the fight was racially motivated. So the women decided not to pursue those charges. Take that plea deal. And I think that's significant because it basically shows that they're willing to take this all the way. I understand that one of the women took the plea deal, and that was, you know, essentially to avoid jail time. And I think that's why most people take plea deals. It doesn't mean that that person is actually guilty. It just means that they don't want to go to jail. And if I'm being totally honest, I actually wish that the women had taken plea deals because I don't want to see them go to jail. That's part of the reason that we did this documentary. We want people to know the truth. And it's unfortunate that you have to decide between lying and saying that you're guilty of something you didn't do just to avoid jail time. And that's kind of speaks to the injustice that's taking place right now.
Hmm. Just for listeners, the third black female in this incident, Alexis Briggs, she's talking, it was reported, she did take the deal. It was reported in the Times Union, the article, Alexis Briggs admits making up UAlbany bus attack racial bias claim. Just so our listeners are informed, it reads, suspended University at Albany student Alexis Briggs tearfully apologized Tuesday while pleading guilty to her role in fabricating a story that she and two friends were victims of an alleged racial attack on a CDTA bus on January 30th. You knew it wasn't true. Albany County Judge Stephen Herrick asked Briggs, who was recently suspended from UAlbany for 2 years. Yes, she answered. Briggs, 21, of Elmira Heights, Chemung County, faced up to a year in jail if convicted of misdemeanor charges that included third-degree assault and falsely reporting an incident. Briggs pleaded guilty to disorderly conduct, a non-criminal violation similar to a traffic ticket. Under the deal, she must perform 100 hours of community service within the next 10 months and avoid any new criminal charges within the next year. Briggs does not have to cooperate against her co-defendants, former college suite mates Aisha Burwell and Ariel Agudio, both of Long Island, who are headed to trial on allegations they concocted the story. I would like to apologize to the community and to all people affected by the events that occurred on January 30th, Briggs told the judge while being consoled by her defense attorney, William Little. I never intended any harm, and I truly regret my actions. I was raised to take responsibility for my actions, and being the source of such negativity is hurtful on many levels. This was not included in the documentary. What would your response be to people who say, hey, this should have been included as part of the film?
I think, again, that was pretty well known. That's something that was put out by the media and kind of blasted all over, social media and media in general. People wanted this to be a hoax. So the purpose of the documentary wasn't to reinforce the things that the media had already said. It was to focus on the things that people didn't know. So yes, the one woman did accept a plea deal. I think it's important to note that she didn't have to incriminate the other woman involved, and she refused to do that. And she wanted to get on with her life. And that's, that's a valid thing. I think if I were in their place, I probably would have accepted the plea deal too. Because when you're up against white supremacy and an entire university and an entire county, things look bleak. But I applaud them for holding out as long as they did, all three women, and definitely applaud Ariel and Aisha for hanging out, for hanging on this long and taking it to trial, because this is an important case and it deserves. I think it deserves to go to trial, and I think the truth deserves a chance to be presented. And even if they end up losing this case, I have nothing but appreciation for the fact that they were willing to stand by their convictions and stand by the truth.
Hmm. I just want to make sure I heard this correctly, because I appreciate people that are willing to tell the truth about the amount of pressure that the system of white supremacy can bring to bear on the lives of black people. You said, if I heard correctly, set me straight if I misheard, that you wished that these young ladies had taken the plea deal so they could just move forward with their lives and not risk any further harm. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I've gotten to know them and gotten to know the case intimately, and I don't want them to go to jail. And it's unfortunate that you're put in a position where you have to decide between, truth and justice and your freedom. And I think that's why that's set up by design. People have to choose between their freedom or sticking to the truth and what actually happened and justice. So, I don't want these women to go to jail. I don't think anybody's safer if they're in jail. I don't even think the most, ardent detractors of these women would say, yeah, I feel safer because, two skinny black girls are in jail. Like, it's not making the society safer. It's not giving anyone justice. It's unfortunate that you have to choose between your freedom or kind of just lying and incriminating yourself, even if it's falsely incriminating yourself.
Mm. Khalif Browder comes to mind for folks who remember what happened to him, also in New York. I wanted to, because just that concept of justice, I think, is so critical. There was a segment, and I played this on the program. This is from February. So this is as they were going to court and they were going to move forward with the indictment of the other two females in this case. And I found the words of the judge in this case, who's a white woman, I found her words so striking. The role of white women in this case cannot be understated. Highlight that when we talk about racism, white supremacy. But I want to play this segment and get your comments on the way that the judge talked about this incident and the question specifically when she says our community. Who do you think she's talking about? That's going to be the question. But just pay attention when the judge is talking about this case and the damage that she thinks it's done. Context of white supremacy.
Attack on the bus.
Emma Cloy breaks it all down. She joins us now with more. Anne?
Liz, Greg, today we learned in addition to a male student, one of the women is now charged with having physical contact with two other passengers during that violent bus ride.
Ariel Agudio, Aisha Burwell, and Alexis Briggs faced a firestorm of media as they walked into court to be arraigned this morning. None of the women, each accused of assault in this incident on a CDTA bus January 30th, would stop to answer questions and stayed quiet throughout the hearing, their lawyers all entering pleas of not guilty.
If proven, those charges do have a profound impact on our community. In fact, if proven, they're shameful.
Today, the Albany County District Attorney announced additional charges of harassment for both Burwell and Agudio. Agudio now facing a total of 6 charges, Burwell 3. The DA also announced altogether, arguing the defense hasn't been given all the evidence against the women, including victim statements and cell phone video.
We don't have them, and I think they should be provided to us promptly.
The motion was denied, the judge saying she wants this case to move through the court system as quickly as possible.
This case really has already done enough damage in our community. It's like an open wound, and I want it resolved.
And today we learned Burwell has moved home to Long Island with her parents and is no longer a student at UAlbany. Agudio and Briggs are still enrolled in school and are allowed to keep their jobs while under supervision.
Like an open wound, she wants it resolved. I think we talk about metaphors on this program a lot as well. Just who, when she says our community, who exactly do you think she's talking about there?
She means white people. It's pretty straightforward. I was in court that day. That was Albany City Judge Rachel Kretzer. And that day in court, she spoke of how she wanted this trial wrapped up quickly. You know, it seemed like the subtext was, regardless of the truth, you know, we want to wrap this up. And one of the other things she said at that trial was that she's speaking to the three women, and she goes, "If you did this, you should be ashamed of yourselves." So she's like, she's on the bench shaming the women for a crime that they're innocent until proven guilty, and it just kind of showed her bias. And you know, we were thrilled that she eventually was superseded by an Albany County judge. But you know, going into the trial and just to have that judge, who's a white woman, speaking down to these three black women, it was so reminiscent of what happened on the bus that night, where you have a white woman antagonizing three black women, and they have to decide, do I defend myself and risk getting into trouble, or do I just sit here and take it? And the women sat in the courtroom as Judge Kretzer was shaming them, and they just had to take it, you know. And it was hard for a lot of us to sit there and be a witness to that glaring bias and white supremacy in action.
Might be another illustration of white victimhood as well. I think that's something that's so important. That's another point that this case hits on so many of the issues that I think are crucial to understanding white supremacy. The role of white women, the white judge in this case, and the intoxicated white girls that were on the bus that started this whole thing, and ratchet this and get a job and all of this, in my view, at least, I think that gets minimized frequently, the role that white women play, the mandatory role that they play in the maintenance of white supremacy. Just can you talk to how that's illustrated in this case?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the white women and white feminism in general are really dangerous, especially to black women, because it's easy for a lot of liberal ideology to take what's being said and presented by white women and say, okay, white women are also an oppressed group, so we have to listen to what they're saying. But we don't really acknowledge the ways that white women and white feminism are detrimental to black women, and how often a lot of the achievements and progress made by women in society are really only reserved for white women at the detriment of women of color, especially black women. So that, you know, we saw that in action in the courtroom, and we even saw it in action when Hillary Clinton tweeted about it, because her reason for tweeting about this case was not because she cared about black women. It was because she cared about black voters. And at the time, the case was hot, and she thought that she could get some more black voters. So she's using black women to gain politically. Now, as soon as the media came out with this other narrative, where's Hillary, you know, Hillary Clinton's never going to speak about these women again. Hillary Clinton doesn't care that these women are facing jail time. You know, so it's like it shows the different ways that white women can benefit from oppressing black women, and how it can be more insidious because it's, you know, it's coming from a woman. The same ways that having a black president at the university and a black district attorney can make it seem like what's happening is fair and just, but it's really at the detriment of black women.
Did white feminists, either like at the university level or, you know, even broader in the city of Albany or New York or wherever, did they come out to support these three young black scholars, these black females?
At the initial rally, it seemed like there was a pretty decent mix of people. There were white people present, but I definitely didn't hear from any, you know, white feminist organizations doing that. But, you know, there were also a lot of, it's worth noting that there were also a lot of black organizations, which are predominantly male-led, that dismissed this case too, you know. So it's not only white women, but also black men who were kind of quick to dismiss it and say, okay, this isn't a priority for us right now. It's just black women. Like, you know, we don't have to believe them. It really doesn't matter. And I think that's just the nature of things. And when we talk about, you know, misogyny and misogynoir and just racism in general, and the intersections of the oppression that, you know, black women face, they're a lot of times left out of the conversation. That's a big part of the reason, again, that when we put out this documentary, we didn't do most interviews. Several people approached us for interviews, and we wanted to focus to stay on the black women, and we were referring them to black women. The only interviews that we granted were you and then another independent journalist, because we felt like they would do the story justice. But yeah, that's something that, you know, black women deal with, and you'd have to ask black women to really have a true understanding of that type of double-edged sword that they're facing.
Hmm. Are there any black people specifically that said that they didn't want to deal with this case because it involved black females?
I'm not going to name names, but yeah, there were definitely you know, black people and black students who wanted to drop the case once they started hearing that narrative. You know, they pretty much ate up the white supremacist narrative, and I think that, you know, black people aren't exempt from anti-blackness, and black people aren't impervious to white supremacy. So the same things that work and trick white people and Trump supporters and conservatives into being anti-black also work on black people, you know. So you could see just by the change in some of the comments and the way people were eating up the media narrative that some, you know, black people were also not willing to defend these women.
Before we get to some of the folks who called in who had a question, I guess you all made a great point about the imaging that was used in the media, where mm-hmm. they would crop some of the images. I think even from the sound clip that I just played from their court appearance, that they would crop some of the images when they were in court to make yep. it look like their hands were handcuffed, like they were shackled. But that was not the case at all. They were not handcuffed. But that's kind of the impression you would get from the way that they cropped the images, as well as they would use graphics where they would have the words false, like in the most huge font possible, all caps, and they would have it just branded across all of these three black females across their entire body. And in fact, in looking at different reports and preparing for the broadcast, there were like mainstream media outlets. I'm talking like CNN, people that, you know, people think of as having some integrity with journalism. They were talking about this case, and they would have an image of the three black females with false in huge font across them. And that wouldn't just be, we have that up at the beginning. They would have that up for the entire segment of the story, just kind of in the corner while they're doing the interview. It was amazing. Just, can you talk about just that form of imaging of white supremacy imaging to criminalize these black females?
Yeah, to criminalize and dehumanize. And actually, before I get into that, I want to say one of the reasons we were careful not to refer to the women as black females is because we believe that's something done to dehumanize the women in the media and also among our own community. So we were very careful, like, to not refer to them as black females. But these black women were intentionally demonized and manipulated by the press from very early on. And it wasn't just, you know, impartial or unbiased journalism. It was an overt campaign to portray the women in a negative light. And that's why they went to such great lengths to make it seem like they were handcuffed in the court. I was in court that day as well. You know, those women weren't in shackles, but the photos would lead you to believe otherwise. And just to be a news organization and to be able to put the word false right on their faces while this is still in trial, it's like, what are you telling the community? You're saying right up front, this is false, this is a hoax, and if you're in the jury pool, you've already seen this. How can these women get a fair trial when you have the mainstream media in the area and nationally already condemning them? You know, there's no way that they can get a fair trial, and the media just took it and ran with it.
Just for comparison's sake, if you want to take someone like Brian Williams, the former, well, I can't even say former, he's back on the air, but the anchor who got White Anchorman, he got caught where he had been making up stories, just lying about these different incidents, even lying about what happened to him during Hurricane Katrina back in 2005. I don't like see his image when they talk about him. I don't see like liar branded across his body and particularly kept on the screen. Like there are many, many whites who have lied about many, many things. I don't see that same type of treatment afforded. And this is something that's even still in dispute, but I guess it's not. I guess they've already concluded. They've already come to a conclusion about this. We'll hit our caller, the person who dialed in. I think this might be our caller in Florida who recommended your film to begin with. Did you have a question? We're talking about the documentary Indefensible. Caller that dialed in with a hand up. Did you have a question, sir? Or ma'am, sorry.
Yes, sir. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, and the guests, and the listeners and callers. I just wanted to ask a question about the reports that were put out. Like I don't know, was that the interview with the three victims? Like I noticed that they wasn't really showing the whole, like, all of the interviews, and I just wanted to bring that up just to echo that the system is very powerful when it comes to how an incident is portrayed when black people are the victims of racism. And was you mentioned that there was a site where the complete video of the bus incident was released. Do you remember what the site was?
I can find that link and I can I can tweet it out later. I don't have it right in front of me right now. All the information was put out there. We just Google searched it to find it, but the district attorney put out all the bus footage anyway. It's worth noting that the bus footage is in like a proprietary format, so it's not easily viewed. You have to install a program. You have to be using a Windows PC. You kind of have to jump through some hoops to even watch it, but it was all put out there. That's not to say that all of the testimony and interrogation and statement footage was made available. That's specifically privy to the prosecution and the defense, so that wasn't made available. But the bus footage was put out, the different angles and the whole footage. It was eventually dumped basically on a district attorney website where the footage was just compiled and archived. I'll see if I can find that while we're finishing out the interview, though.
I'll retweet it if you tweet it out. Okay. Did you have another question, sir, caller?
That's all I can think of for now. Thanks, Gus.
For sure, for sure. The caller at last four digits, 6900. Did you have a question?
Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to the guests. I want to thank Gus for having the guest on the show. This is Jay out of New York. I'm a graduate of SUNY Albany of the mid-90s. And this story actually kind of really hit home when I saw it on social media. And the alumni community, I guess I would call it the black alumni community, initially had this all over social media in the first couple of days that it came out. As soon as the media broke with the lies that they started spewing about the story, it was amazing how quickly the black alumni on social media just totally shifted gears in the support for the three black scholars. And I would even include myself. I was kind of like just on a seesaw trying to figure out. But then I thought about my time in Albany, and anyone who went to Albany and lived in the Albany area knows that if you're on a bus, especially that SUNY Albany bus, and you're three black women surrounded by the amount of white students that were on that bus, they were not going to be the aggressors on that bus. They've had instances in Albany where things had taken place, but in that scenario, it just wouldn't have even made logical sense for them to be the aggressors on that bus. And it's just kind of like baffling for me at this point. And I guess we always say it, white supremacy is going to do what they're going to do. But it is kind of, and I know that we're all victims, but the way that the shift happened with the black alumni, it even makes me feel even worse that I didn't do more to kind of push this out there. But to the guests, I do thank you for the video. I will be pushing that out to the social media channels that I'm with and kind of all the black SUNY alumni circles that are out there, because I think we do have to revive this, because if these women are still dealing with the amount of time that they have kind of with the system, hopefully we could do something to kind of give some type of support to them to hopefully change this verdict around a little bit.
Wow. Thank you. I want to address that, but I also want to say to the previous person who asked a question about the bus footage, we just tweeted it out. So if you go to Indefensible Doc on Twitter, you can I put up the link to that. I also emailed it to the Cows podcast host, so you should have that in your email as well. But yeah, there's so many things that could have been done to help support these women and keep the narrative at least even, so people could have a chance to know what the truth was. And a lot of people, I think, immediately just kind of started taking the law enforcement and the district attorney's version of events and the university's version of events, and that's dangerous. You know, when you have all of these resources at your disposal, news cameras and the media and the whole judicial system in your favor, it's easy to sway people. This documentary was difficult to do because we don't have the same resources that white supremacy has at their disposal, you know, and that's why there's not more documentaries like this. But it's important to remember that we can still support them. There are different ways that we can help these women. It's not lost. The case is still happening. If you go to indefensibledocumentary.com, we have a new page up that says Take Action. And if you click on it, there are 6 ways that you can help, and you don't even have to be in the area. You can write letters to the district attorney. You can write to the university. You can share this so people know, let people know what's going on. And even if it doesn't reverse the system or even get these women justice, it can help the women by letting them know that their story and their truth is out there, and it wasn't just dismissed by the entire society. You know, so there are ways we can help, and it's not over yet.
And just one quick question again, Gus. Sorry about that. In reference to any of the organizations, the Greek organizations, have any of those organizations stepped up and done anything in reference to providing any financial, any type of support that you know of?
Not that I know of. To my knowledge, and I'm a little far removed from the university now, I used to be heavily involved. To my knowledge, the main person or team taking on this from the university are some of the students, some of whom were in the video, Angelica Clark and Deidre Michelle. They're either teachers or former students of the university, and also Professor Chandler, who's a tenured professor there now. They're the only ones that I've heard from the university that have continued to kind of keep this in the light. I'm sure there are other individuals. There's definitely other students in support, but no other organizations related to the university have reached out to us or some of the other local organizations. So it seems like the university has done a really good job of suppressing the information and getting, you know, the rest of the student body on board with their, you know, their false narrative.
That answer your question, sir?
Yes, it did. Thank you very much.
For sure. Caller in New York, did you have a question? We're discussing the documentary film Indefensible.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Good evening, Gus. And I just want to thank the creator of this documentary that's speaking. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this and to share this story of these three women. It actually reminds me of the Tawana Brawley case and how white suppressed that and called that a hoax. And I see the pattern there where they, you know, suppress the voice of black women, including the woman that was, I don't know if she was raped by Dominique Strauss-Kahn, but the African woman that was attacked by him. So again, I just want to say thank you for your work, and my prayers will be with these women. Thank you.
Wow, thank you. And we just want to remind you there's a lot of organizations that are working to support these women in the Albany area. And, you know, they're doing the real work. And I think the women themselves are doing the real work by just staying in this case. So it's worth noting that, when we do this type of work, a lot of it is out of selfishness. You know, I don't want this to happen to me. I don't want this to happen to people that I care about and know. I don't want this to happen to other people in my community. So we have to do this work, and we just have to remember that it, just because it's not us this time, it could be us next time. So, there's a reason why people are so impassioned about this and why this case resonated with so many people. But thank you for your comment.
For sure. I retweeted the link where you can download the footage. So for people who follow at Until Justice, you can, it's right at the top of my timeline. So you can get that link and you can follow them on Twitter as well. It's at Indefensible Doc, at Indefensible Doc. You can follow them on Twitter to get updates as well. And I also tweeted out their link for ways that you can take action. So you can get that as well. Are you familiar with the 2007 film Spinning into Butter? Sarah Jessica Parker was in it?
No.
Okay. That's come up a few times on the program. I was reminded of that with this whole case. Because, and Nafissatou Diallo is the name of the black female who was sexually terrorized by Dominic Strauss-Kahn. That was 2011. But Spinning into Butter, I was reminded of it. The movie is about, there's an incident or several incidents of racism on a Northeast college campus. And the press gets involved and they have all these meetings to try to figure out what's happening. It's like one or it's very, very few black students on this campus. So they're trying to figure out what happened. They get to the end and it turns out that the black student made all of this up, but did so because he was trying to bring attention to racism. And so that's how all of this concludes. It's kind of a strange movie, but it was brought up before. At any rate, the reason I brought it up is because we've had quite a few other incidents of racism, white supremacy on college campuses. The incident that happened at Oberlin College, that was, I believe, 2012. We had students from the University of Michigan with their campaign, the University of Cincinnati, San Jose State. I mean, all over the world, University of South Africa. This is a global problem. But one of the patterns that I've seen is that it will be consistently, this is another spinning into butter. Black people just made this up. They're always making up allegations of racism. That's one of the patterns that I've seen. And one of the points I think you started at the beginning of the program, you said that this is beyond just these three black female scholars. It's beyond them, that this is, you know, a greater issue of dealing, addressing, confronting white supremacy. And just if you could speak, because I think it's so important, consistently when black people, when we say we're being mistreated, we're being abused, it's discounted. It's invalidated in some way that you're lying. You're making it all up. You're just trying to find a way to blame white people for your troubles. Just can you address that pattern?
Yeah, I mean, this happens with every type of oppression. And it's just hard to convince people who are privileged about what, you know, what oppression looks like to you. I think my best way, my favorite way to like present this is when you look at the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA Act that was passed, I believe in the 70s. And it's like this act went in place to do a lot of things for people with disabilities. And one of the things was to make sure that we can get wheelchair ramps on sidewalks, right? Now, wheelchairs have been around for hundreds of years, and people have been struggling to get on sidewalks for hundreds of years and been saying that, hey, this is a problem for hundreds of years. And it wasn't until the 70s where we're like, okay, all right, there must be really a problem. Maybe we should address it. And I think the same thing happens today when you talk about racism, because before we can even combat racism within white supremacy, at least with white people, we have to convince them that we're, you know, that this is actually racism. And there's such a poor understanding of what constitutes racism and bigotry and prejudice that people are not willing to listen, and if they did listen, that would mean they have to admit that they're complicit in this, and nobody wants to admit that, you know. Just like people who were walking on sidewalks that didn't have ramps didn't want to admit that there was a problem because it didn't affect them. So I think that's kind of tied to this case, and that this idea of not believing people when they're describing instances of racism or oppression or not being able to see it is, you know, it's universal. You know, it happens to marginalized people all over the world. And, you know, what happened at UAlbany isn't that unique. You know, it's really, this happens all the time. The only thing unique about it was how much the case kind of got blown up and how aggressively the women were being prosecuted. But these type of micro and macro aggressions happen all the time. And convincing white supremacy is exhausting, you know, and frankly, we shouldn't have to.
Racial battle fatigue. Just talked about that on the program this month. Before we don't want to take up your whole evening, I did want to make sure to elaborate because I thought that was an important point when you were talking about the punitive actions that the university took. They expelled two of these students and the other, I believe Ms. Briggs, she was suspended for 2 years. before there was even any resolution to the criminal aspect of the case. And you talk about you talk about that in the film and how that was also a violation of due process. I believe it was Article 11 that you addressed specifically in the film. Just can you give some of that information to our listeners?
Yeah, you mean just the different ways that the university was like going after the women, or you, because we talked about Count 11, which was specifically related to the rally.
Right.
Is that the one you're?
Right. And I guess not being able to defend, I think you were saying the way it was presented in the film that rally, other people were not allowed to defend them as well.
Yeah. So the rally was essentially a way, you know, for people to show support and defend these women. And it was like this additional charge was thrown at the women, not the people who organized the rally. And it's kind of, you know, it's almost like to set an example. Like if you come out and support of somebody and the university or the county doesn't like it, they can add additional charges. So say you and I are gunned down by the police. And then our friends and family, you know, throw a rally, and then suddenly they're charging people, other people involved who didn't even throw the rally. They're just saying, oh, because you let this rally happen, we're going to charge you now. You know, that's a scary thought, because now it's like you can't speak out, you can't even defend yourself against the system without having additional charges levied against you. So it's like the system is coming at you from all angles, and you can't even throw. The right to assemble, it used to be or should be a cornerstone of what we call American freedom, right? And that the fact that that's taken away in this instance, where black women are throwing a rally and using their own power and their own agency to do it, and that suddenly become a criminal act. And meanwhile, in the same city, we have the KKK have rallies. The Westboro Baptist Church have come here and had rallies, and they're not being charged. It kind of just shows that the different ways that freedom of speech and the freedoms in this country are afforded to some at the expense of others.
Context of white supremacy, for sure. Also wanted to make sure I got in. I appreciate you giving your explanation, the reasoning as to why you deliberately do not use the term female. I do have deliberate reason why I say black male and black female specifically, and I do not say black men and black women, but I will do that another day. Before we wrap up, I just, again, want to remind people you can see the entire documentary. It's available for free. You can go to indefensibledocumentary.com. It's linked in the description for the program, indefensibledocumentary.com. You can download it, share it, get it out to as many people as possible. I think it's really important that folks do not just kind of forget this event, ho-hum, and move on as we go into 2017, because you can, as has been stated consistently, there's still help. There's still things that can be done to support in this case. And I tweeted that as well, just on at Until Justice, about six ways you can take action. That's also at indefensibledocumentary.com, the six ways, things that you can do to continue to help and support with this case. Anything
thank you so much. Thank you so much for tweeting that out. That's the most important part of this whole thing. Even more important, I think, than the documentary is just letting people know the ways that they can help. So thank you for tweeting that out.
Oh, for sure. Thank you for all of the immense work, the website, the film, and everything. And not just you, I'm sure all of the people that contributed in some way, shape, form in putting the project together, time, editing, interviews, finances, whatever, getting the word out, the website and all that. That's a lot of man and woman hours invested to get that project together. So thanks to all of the people who contributed, not just yourself. And thank you for sharing your time with us. But anything else folks should know about or should be on the lookout, or can they just go to the website for updates and information?
Yeah, they can go to the website. Definitely click the Take Action link. I do want to say, what we were able to do with the documentary took a lot of time, and time comes with privilege. So if you have time or you know someone who has time to afford to these things, you can get a lot done with that time. So this whole documentary was really brought together by two or three people, in addition to the people that we brought in to interview and provide their expertise. But in terms of the technical aspect, it was really a very small group of people who did this, and the time was the main resource that we had. So if you have access to some computers and some time and to investigate and do some know-how, you can make a pretty substantial piece of media and counter narrative out there. And if anyone has questions, you can tweet us at indefensibledoc, or shoot an email to indefensibledoc
documentary at gmail.com. And, you know, we'd be willing to help or give you some tips in how to get something like this going. So with just a little bit of resources and some time, you can really change the narrative and do this work.
Man, that is brilliant. We talk about how we use our time and energy on the program all the time. That is so, so crucial. So I super appreciate that as well. Everything has been great, but that is fundamental, just changing the way we use our time and energy. And again, massive commendation to all of the folks, you specifically, and everyone who pitched in, your small team who put this project together. Just phenomenal illustration of Black self-respect, supporting these Black female scholars. And I think it's great, and I will continue to share. And as we proceed, if you all are willing to come back and speak with us to kind of update, is this, I guess this is going to trial, so we will definitely.
Well, what I would like to do is like maybe challenge you to have reach out to some of the women, reach out to Dr. Chandler, and it's important to keep, you know, to center the women and get their voice and get their opinion on this. But that's something I can even talk to you with if you want to get in touch with some of these people. That I'd love to be a part of that.
Oh, absolutely. I am I guess the only hesitant I have, if you're saying the victims in the case, because the criminal or the case pending, I guess I'd have hesitancy about that. No people can be restricted about what to say or not, but certainly Dr. Chandler.
Oh, yeah.
Anyone else?
Yeah, until the trial's over, the women probably couldn't speak. But yeah, there are definitely other women who are kind of helping locally lead the campaign and kind of support the women. So I can give you those names and maybe you could get them on and get an even more robust perspective on this.
Oh, absolutely. Done deal. We will make that happen immediately. Thank you. I think it's a monumental act of Black self-respect, what you and the folks involved are doing, and just monumental appreciation and well-earned for the work that you're doing. Continue the effort, and we will definitely be in contact to follow up and get some of your other recommendations to get more information about this incident.
Cool. Thank you.
For sure. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and thanks again so much for sharing some of your time with us, sir.
Will do. Thank you so much for having us on the show. We really appreciate it. Look forward to the podcast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Take excellent care and stay safe. You and everyone else. Stay safe.
Yep. Good night.
Good evening. Context of White Supremacy. That website again, indefensibledocumentary.com. Indefensibledocumentary.com. And we will follow up. We'll get more information on their support. And thank you to our caller down in Florida. He mentioned the documentary film this past weekend. I had said that I wanted to kind of keep an eye on this case. I thought it was important. We were talking about it back in January and February and I guess on up through May or so. But I wanted to keep an eye and just follow up with this. So absolutely, we'll be staying tuned. And this can be another tool to teach. If you have college students or maybe soon to be college students, can maybe be another method of teaching other Black people about the system of racism, white supremacy. I cannot let it go. The role of alcohol in this whole situation. That's something we talk about on this program all the time. Again, some moron saying sobriety would be best under the system of white supremacy. And I believe our guest, the filmmaker, I think he did share that the Black females in this case, that they were not intoxicated. This is another example I would submit. Anybody out there, if you think that these Black females would have done better if they had been, you know, had a blunt or some alcohol, step forward and let's hear that logic. If you think that this would have worked out better for them if they had been intoxicated too. Anywho, with whites and alcohol, stated that for years, that's one of the most dangerous combinations in the known universe. And I use this unfortunate incident to, again, highlight that's really something that we have to just take seriously. Whites are dangerous. The system of racism, white supremacy is war against non-white people. And we just have to have that in mind at all times, the danger that we are in as vulnerable victims of racism. That's Black females, Black males, Black children. We are in a vulnerable position, and that can happen any time. We did that whole program back in 2012. White people can ruin your life in a matter of minutes. And white women were at the center of that broadcast as well. If you remember, and I believe it was white women and alcohol. I just want to play Mr. Fuller. He spoke to that whole issue and why we should take this really, really serious. And even if you kind of see yourself in this sort of situation where it looks like it might be some whites and they're under the influence of it being rowdy or what have you, to just immediately be like, man, we need to be on high alert. Maybe we need to move. Maybe we need to get off this bus. We need to exit immediately because this could go really, really bad. And just this whole incident, it reminded me of that incident. And there are quite a few others where people have shared with just things. It just can go from calm to total combat, and it'll be something small like that. A white person, you know, saying ratchet or nigger, or they just make some sort of racist comment, and it just, particularly if alcohol is involved. So I just want to play that again, and again, super gratitude and thanks to the filmmakers, our guest for this evening specifically, and all the folks involved with the project. Just monumental illustration of black self-respect in supporting these black females in this case. But this is Mr. Fuller talking about the dangers of whites and alcohol, context of white supermacy.
White woman with hair. Niggas don't take precedence over that. Period. Now, see that? That got way out of hand, and see, of course, this is all Monday morning quarterbacking I'm doing here, but see, a person has to be conscious. These are life-changing things. People have to be aware of that. Things come out of nowhere. You have to be on your toes all the time, and you got to always come up with the what-ifs in just a few minutes, and you can't look at it like you got anybody on your side. So everything has got to be almost, you know, hey, open and shut. Now, when the ladies start tossing their hair back there, that's got to be thought of immediately. Uh-oh, here we go. Here's a life-changing incident. Everybody involved in here now is going to be, they're going to be dogged with this incident the rest of their lives. That's the way to look at it.
Right now with the red shirt, looked me in my eye, directly in my eye, and said, "You're next."
White woman tossing her hair on some black people and whatnot in a restaurant full of white people and all like that. You think you're gonna get the best of that story? Not at all. That's the way you're supposed to be thinking. This is a war situation here, and we are surrounded by enemy. With reinforcements coming. Now, if you're not prepared to kill everybody who's an aggressor, you don't show no signs of aggression. You surrender in that situation. Have to.
When you say surrender, what do you mean?
You don't make no protests. I wouldn't. That white woman tossing her hair over there, I would go and ask for another booth or something if I couldn't sell it with her. If I asked her not to do that, she says she's not going to do it. Kiss her, whatever. I would just go and say, well, I need another booth because we're having a problem over here. Okay. And if they don't want to give me another booth and all like that, well, then, hey, maybe this ain't the place I should be no way. That's just the way it is. Your antenna has got to be up that, you know, this race thing doesn't go away. It dominates everything. That's got to be in your mind all the time. Now, that's a terrible way to have to be in the world, but that's what I talk about. That's the world that we're in. You know, and when everything is relatively quiet and whatnot, people call in the programs and all like that and say, you know, well, you know, hey, he's old school and whatnot, and he's making it all up. That ain't got nothing to do with what's happening now. My experience has been this, and my experience has been that, and that's when you drop your guard. And that's when you lose your job, and 5 years later, you are in the lockup on account of your financial situation has gone completely to pot for the rest of your life. That's how they do it. It ain't by magic. It's all by plan. And that white woman would say, yeah, I just tossed my hair on them niggas, you know. Hey, white woman white with hair. Woman with hair, you know? Hair, you know? Niggas don't take precedence over that. Period. They got to learn the hard way. They did.
Context of white supremacy. That is Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. And just to make sure there is no confusion, I'm in no way playing that audio segment to suggest in any manner that the black female scholars in this situation did anything incorrect, or even in the situation Mr. Fuller is talking about. I only play that with importance and emphasize the seriousness of it. Because I think what Mr. Fuller is saying is recommending that we really be mindful. When my blog, it says racism is war. When I use that term, terrorism, that's the mind frame that we have to be in. As he stated, that's unfortunate. It's terrible to have to think that that's the world that we have. That's what we have. Unfortunate. And just seeing a situation, when I say whites and alcohol, one of the worst combinations in the known universe. It can happen so quickly where things can ignite. And as he stated, an incident, a situation where you have legal fees and just all of this, and whites, they have a whole racist apparatus army that's just waiting, where they can just make up things and lie and take up your time and take up your money and take your health. And I mean, it's it is frightening. It is, I mean, really, it's terrifying. Just and how easily and how frequently these types of events happen, that something so small and, you know, all of this. So just to really keep that in mind as we move throughout our day and these type of episodes and how we function and just the importance of counter-racist codification in terms of thinking about how we want to respond, what to say, what to do, the best way to conduct ourselves in these situations, and keeping in mind that we're not going to have, you know, a whole lot of backup, an army of people coming to hold it down for us, that, you know, we're going to have to deal with this situation as best we can, and just trying to get out as safe as possible is, that is racism, white supremacy, unfortunately. But I'm always about it, and I tell this to everybody, and I employ this myself anytime. If you see intoxicated whites, man, try to steer clear of those environments. If it's something like a bus or something like that, if you can move to a different area, great. Even if you might need to sacrifice the bus, that might be something to think about. And again, you know, this is code that I employ just because I recognize that as a massive source of danger to black people, whites, and being under substances, alcohol, drugs, whatever it is. Wow, they're dangerous when they're sober. It's dramatically magnified if they're under the influence. I will stop there. I have an issue, so we will be wrapping in about 3 minutes. I'm going to hit retired firefighter. Did you have a comment you wanted to get in before we get ready to wrap up, sir? I don't know if he might have just been just listening. Retired firefighter, did you?
Oh, I had it on mute. Okay. I was talking all the while, but I forgot I had it on mute. Just to reinforce on what you just finished talking about, and Mr. Fuller, very clearly to me is illustrating, and especially with white women, very dangerous. We have to understand that white women are protected by a global system. If one thinks that, oh, well, I'm a male, I'm a black male, I ain't even going to bow down to this white woman, you know, or assume that she is interested in that black male sexually, or, you know, whatever, that it could quickly change on you to the worst. A classic case, Iverson, Allen Iverson, how immediately, within seconds, his life changed, within seconds, innocently at a bowling alley. And yes, there were white males involved, but specifically, I believe would even up the case even more. There were white females involved that said that people were throwing chairs and got hit, and one of them got hit upside the head. You know, something like that. I believe Randy Moss was in a similar situation in and around the same time from the transition from going to high school to college, and which totally changed his life, if I'm correct on it. I know he was arrested on something similar. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but there's tons of cases involved where white females directly are involved. You go to these professional football games. You're gonna see oodles of drunk white people wandering around out in the clear open, and it don't take much. It don't take much. You said something about the Packers, and I'm a Packer fan, and it's on. In its own. And it's not going to go well if you're a black person in and around that atmosphere.
30
you
seconds.
Know, because, oh, that's it. That's it. That's all I wanted to say on that. And so thank you for letting me state that. Thank you.
For sure. For sure. I just want to reiterate the documentary, indefensibledocumentary.com. You can download it. You can watch it online. Share it. Great material. I think you should check it out. If you have college students or soon to be college students, get them to check it out. It might be a great way to get some younger black people to think seriously about the issues of racism. And I just, again, want to salute both our guests this evening and all the folks involved in the project for stepping up to support these black females. I think that is just an absolutely phenomenal illustration of black self-respect. I am sure Dr. Frances Cress Welsing would be elated at seeing black people coming out to make sure that they are not forgotten and to get out information from their perspective to combat the way that racism, white supremacy can really warp our thinking. I thought that was such a crucial component of the documentary as well. The cropping of the images to make them look like they were in handcuffs and branding false across their images, their bodies. Huge aspects of white supremacy, and they just can be very effective at contaminating all of our brain computers. With that, we'll be here tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, for Workplace Racism. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Thanks to our guests. Check out the film, indefensibledocumentary.com. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.